Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
This week, I am pleased to invite Dr. Philip Sinnatare, a professor of history at the College of Biblical Studies in Houston, Texas, and a visiting assistant professor at Sam Houston State University. He holds a PhD from the University of Houston. Professor Sinnatare specializes in a number of topics, including American religious history, African-American religiosity, and the history of world religion. He has written numerous articles on these topics, as well as authoring, co-authoring, or editing several books, including Holy Mavericks, Evangelical Innovators and America's Spiritual Marketplace, Protest and Propaganda, W.E.B. Du Bois and the Crisis and American History, Christians and the Color Line, Race and Religion After Divided by Faith, and his most recent solo-authored work, Salvation with a Smile, Joel Osteen, Lakewood Church, and American Christianity. We always provide links to our guest books, their websites, and related podcasts over at Research on Religion, so please do visit us so that you can learn more about these great guests and topics. Philip, welcome to Research on Religion.
Thanks for having me, Tony.
Based on your biography that I just ran through, it's pretty clear that you have two distinct research agendas that are going on. One is African-American religiosity and an interest in big-time evangelical preachers. That would be the second one. Some of those who are often Caucasian. How did you come upon these topics for your research interest? And is there anything that ties these two research streams together, or are they distinct?
I came upon these research topics based on my personal background as well as my experience in college and graduate school. I grew up in Houston, one of the buckles on the so-called Bible Belt, and I grew up saturated in American evangelical culture. At the same time, I grew up in a neighborhood that was very racially and ethnically and economically diverse, so questions of religion and race are rooted in my childhood experiences, and so I naturally gravitated towards these questions both as an undergraduate and a graduate student, focusing on historical study, and I had a number of influential professors in both fields who kind of inspired me by their teaching and research, and I ended up moving into both fields. The things that tie these topics together really are my broader interest in intellectual and cultural history. Sometimes these research interests cohere together with regard to African American studies and American religion, such as in my research to date on W.E.B. Du Bois and American religion, but at other times they operate as distinctly separate projects, such as this project we're talking about today on Joel Osteen and American Christianity.
Yeah, where did you do your undergraduate research, or undergraduate studies, I should say?
I started as a history and political science major at the University of Houston and then finished a BA and MA in history at Sam Houston State. And completed my PhD in history at the University of Houston.
Yeah, so you're total cougar all the way through.
Yes.
Okay, so the University of Houston Cougars, if I'm correct, right?
That's right.
Yeah,
that's
they had a great basketball team in days gone by, and a really good football team nowadays too. So
yes, yeah, and a championship golf team back in the day as well.
Wow. Okay. Well, you're a Houston kid, and you don't sound like you have a Houston accent. But is that something you had to overcome, or Am I mistaking the Houston accent? You do have it, and I just have a non-Houston accent. I don't know.
No, I've heard that numerous times. I don't really have an explanation for that. My parents have roots in southwestern Louisiana, so traveling there as a kid, I was immersed in kind of Cajun culture and the southern Louisiana accent, I suppose, in one sense. But for some reason, I was able to escape the Texas drawl, I suppose.
Hmm. Yeah, well, I might have a little bit of that Texas drawl because I said Joel Osteen and you said Joel Osteen. I'm not sure which way it's pronounced. I guess that's my Wisconsin accent coming through and calling him Osteen. But I'll try to remember to call him Joel Osteen. Is that the typical pronunciation? Is that how he calls himself?
Yeah, Osteen.
Osteen,
that's
okay.
Right.
All right. Well, we want to take a closer look on that book that you've written on Joel Osteen. The book is called Salvation with a Smile, and Reverend Osteen is down there in the Houston area. So I'm guessing you've had a chance to stop into Lakewood Church. And I want to start off, you already hinted at this a little bit, growing up in a mixed ethnic, racial neighborhood, religion was very important there. But tell me a little bit more about your religious upbringing. And then more importantly, when you went to Lakewood Church or when you went to your first mega church, what was it like walking into something like Lakewood that serves 40,000 people a weekend? I mean, wow, that must be odd.
Growing up in Houston, my exposure was to primarily non-denominational evangelical congregations and a few Baptist congregations here and there, and I should say rather small congregations, maybe in the hundreds at best. And so, as I reflect back on that now, and walking into Lakewood Church for the first time, I was impressed and impacted, I suppose, by the sheer largesse, the size of it. And I should say that as a kid, even though I don't ever recall attending Lakewood Church, I knew people who attended, and I have recollections of seeing John Osteen on local television and Lakewood Church bumper stickers on cars motoring along Houston's highways and byways.
So what was it like that first time?
My mind as I walked into Lakewood for the first time, and I should say the new Lakewood Church, that is the new location in the Greenway Plaza area of Houston. I did not visit the church in its previous location, so the largesse was very impactful. I found people very welcoming and smiling. I remember distinctly the first time that I was walking. As you enter Lakewood, from the east side, you walk through a large number of glass doors, and you ascend stairs or take the escalator, and then you're kind of ushered into this arena-like setting. And as I was making my way to the entrance to the worship arena or worship center, I was greeted by apparently a recruiter for the choir, and I was asked if I wanted to be part of Lakewood's choir. And I was shocked at this invitation on my first visit, but I returned the smile and politely declined.
Yeah.
The other recollection that I have from the first time I visited, once the worship music got going, it was extraordinarily loud, very much a concert-like atmosphere. And so as I think back here 11 years later, between my first visit to Lakewood and now, those are the memories that really stick out.
Mm-hmm. That must have been very unusual to be approached to sing in the choir right off the bat. Usually you have to do auditions, I would think. You must look like Luciano Pavarotti or something. It's, oh, finally Pavarotti's come. Here, come on up and sing. You know, do a nice rendition of some opera for us. But that must have been odd.
Yeah, it was a very unique experience. I don't know that I look like I have any musical ability, and I certainly don't. So it was. It really kind of, in retrospect, it reflects a willingness of Lakewood members to engage people in the congregation, whether or not they know if they're first-time attendees or regular members. So it's a, I think it's an expression of outreach as much as anything else. But yeah, it'll be a story that I think I'll tell for a long time to come.
It must be somewhat unusual to go into some place that you're going up an escalator, so they're moving a lot of people. It's a big auditorium, and I would imagine that there's a tendency to feel very small in a place like that. But as you mentioned, somebody reached out and said, "Do you want to sing in the choir?" Were there other efforts to make the church seem smaller when you went in there for the first time, to make it feel more friendly rather than you were just, say, passing through a shopping mall unnoticed?
Sure. Yeah, there are efforts along those lines. One of the things that comes to mind, and again, this is probably another experience I had the first time I went, is not only is one welcomed to the congregation and ushered to seats, but there are also stated opportunities in terms of Sunday school classes or adult education classes more properly. And so those opportunities are made present really on a regular basis. And so the kind of implicit message is, while you're in the worship arena and seemingly one person amongst about 40,000 people, there are ways that the church tries to connect people into kind of smaller settings or smaller groups where people don't necessarily feel anonymous, but can somehow feel part of the congregational life in a more explicit way outside of the kind of concert-like atmosphere of the worship arena.
Now, did you walk in there with any stereotypical images inside your head? I mean, you've seen Lakewood Church in the media before, and you see these big mega churches. Do you have any preconceived notions, and were those preconceived notions met, or were some of them exploded a little bit?
Yeah, I would say, prior to attending the church, I had seen Joel Osteen on TV and had understood the church in terms of this kind of 30-minute broadcast. I don't know that I was particularly enamored with the prosperity gospel. I wasn't personally drawn to the message. I don't know that I was a fierce critic either. I was more of a kind of interested observer. So I certainly didn't go in as a supporter. I don't know that I necessarily was consciously going in as a critic, but simply fascinated by this kind of national story, this emerging story, because again, the first time I attended was the fall of 2005, so this is several months after Lakewood had moved into the Compaq Center, which was a kind of national story. So I was more curious than anything else. The first time I went in, and so trying to seek to understand this national development in my own backyard, so to speak, in my hometown.
Now, you mentioned that growing up, you had a lot of interest in religion and racial issues because of the neighborhood that you grew up in, your background. But what about investigating Lakewood Church as a specific topic for research? I mean, why did you specifically choose that one? There could be a lot of other churches that you could look at, or the mega church phenomena more broadly. What brought you to the point of thinking about Osteen and Lakewood Church?
Well, at the time, in late 2005, I was moving towards the end of my doctoral coursework at the University of Houston, and I had some exposure to kind of local history, or the history of Houston and the Sun Belt. So, realizing that this local development was happening, I was intrigued that I could potentially begin a research topic without necessarily having to travel across the country to do archival research, etc. So that was one kind of motivation early on. And then secondly, I was also taking classes at the time from Andrew Chestnut, the author of Competitive Spirits, among other books, and I was kind of immersed at the time in understanding and researching and trying to understand the theory of religious economy. And it made sense at that moment to me to try to apply a kind of religious economy analysis to Lakewood Church, or at least posed that question. And so that fall, for my first visit, it was initially for a paper I was writing for an independent study I was doing with Professor Chestnut. So I went in kind of with my initially with my research hat on and my historian's hat on to try to make sense of this from a historical perspective more broadly, but also trying to understand a bit of local history and perhaps understand the town that I grew up in a little bit better.
A small world. Andrew Chestnut was a contemporary of mine in graduate school at UCLA. He was he came in a few years later and was in the history department while I was in political science. So,
okay.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting how that all connects together. But again, you know, we study these same topics, so inevitably we always find one another somewhere.
Sure.
You go in 2005. Now, this book was just published a month or two ago, and so that looks like it's a 10-year project, including time to be just writing the book and have it copy edited, which could be about a year or so. So over the course of 9 or 10 years, you're looking into this, you're going back to the church several times. Did your research focus change at all during this period?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, initially, again, the motivation for visiting Lakewood was for this independent study on religious economy. And the following year, I linked up with Shane Lee, author of a biography on T.D. Jakes, among other books. And we ended up working together on the book Holy Mavericks. And so little did I know the initial research in 2005 would really become the core of the Joel Osteen chapter in Holy Mavericks. And so in that particular incarnation of the project, I was really interested in understanding Lakewood Church from the vantage point of religious economy. But as I did the research for the chapter and as we worked on the chapter together, I compiled so much research material that I could hardly include all of it in the space of one book chapter. And so at that point, I began to think about the possibility of doing a much larger book-length project on Lakewood Church. So Holy Mavericks came out in 2009, and meanwhile, I should add, I'm finishing doctoral work, I'm writing a PhD dissertation, and so on and so forth. So as I finished the PhD and started collegiate teaching, then the Salvation with a Smile came more clearly into view as a book project. And so all the while, I continued to do field work and visit Lakewood Church. I continued to keep an eye on the development of Joel Osteen's career, the numerous publications in terms of his books, the increasing number of critics that began to publicly take issue with some of Osteen's teachings. And so in 2010, 2011, I started formulating book proposals and outlining chapters. And so that was when I really settled in on this particular book project. And so my interest then transitioned from not so much understanding Lakewood Church from the perspective of religious economy, but kind of digging deeper into the past to understand its origins and really ask ultimately two questions. Two broad questions. How did Joel Osteen become Joel Osteen, the megachurch, mega minister, superstar, New York Times best-selling author, televangelist? And then how did Lakewood Church become the largest megachurch in the United States? So over time, these became really my driving research questions.
What kind of methodology did you use in this? I know historians are very particular about their methodology. We think about them digging in archives and doing, you know, looking at old documents. But how did you approach this? Did you do multiple sources, or what did you do?
Yeah, I would say the methodology is primarily, I suppose, traditional historical methodology, by which I mean archival research, piecing together the history of something based on the existing documentary record. And so I visited archives all over the country and ordered archival materials from archives all over the country particularly in the Lakewood's early years. But then, because I was researching and writing about an active, living, breathing congregation, then I also tried to do field work and a bit of ethnography. And Randall Balmer, in his writing on evangelicalism, talks about being what he calls a shade tree sociologist. And so my doctoral training and early writing and exposure to scholarship was very much cross-disciplinary in nature. And so even though this book and my methodology is rooted in the archive and documentary evidence, I tried to make sense of the broader cultural and historical totality of this congregation by conducting field work and participant observation and interviewing people as well.
Did you ever get to meet Joel Osteen during the process of this research?
I never got a chance to sit down with Joel Osteen or members of the family. One of the events, church events, congregation events that I attended for research, I had a chance to introduce myself and shake his hand and so forth, but I was one of hundreds of attendees of this particular event, so it was a sort of passing greeting. But no, I never did get the chance to interview the leadership of the church.
I can imagine that he's a difficult person to get in touch with. You know, 40,000 people coming every Sunday. Everybody wants to meet and greet him, and you only have so much time.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. Did you talk to anybody else at the church? Did you talk to regular congregants or ushers or members of the choir other than being asked if you want to sing?
Sure, I would say all of the above. You know, I did field work on and off, I would say, for this 10-year period or so. And, you know, I attended a variety of classes and, you know, inevitably ended up meeting people, and I would always introduce myself as a researcher and teacher, but after attending the same class over a period of time, I developed relationships and even friendships with people, and many of these folks ended up agreeing to sit down for an interview. And so that's the way that I ended up meeting people.
Okay. Well, let's go ahead and dig into the history of this. You're a historian, and you looked at some of the archival stuff, and we'll talk a little bit more about your anthropological, ethnography, contemporary stuff later. But let's go back to the origins of Lakewood Church, which predates Joel Osteen, and it actually goes back to his father, John. So when and where did Lakewood come from, and how did it grow over time?
Lakewood Church started in the year of 1959, and the church began in a small feed store, and the congregational numbers were small, but it began as really a kind of Baptist-rooted, charismatic congregation. But to understand that moment of Lakewood's origins, we have to go back to John Osteen's personal history. He grew up during the era of the Great Depression. He was born in North Texas and had a very difficult upbringing in terms of economic scarcity. And he grew up also going to Southern Baptist churches, but in his later teen years, as he reports in his books and as his son Joel tells the story, he quote-unquote gave his heart to Jesus. And at that point, John began a kind of itinerant preaching ministry, and he spends time in college in Siloam Springs, Arkansas, at John Brown University, which is one of the important schools and institutions with regard to the larger history and longer history of the Christian right and broadly speaking, conservative evangelicalism. And then after that, John attends Northern Baptist Theological Seminary, where he graduates in 1944, and he wrote a master's thesis on basically religious education in a congregational setting. And so at this point, John is a tried and true Southern Baptist, and he comes back to Texas after seminary, and he graduates in 1944 at the end of World War II, but he also spends time pastoring churches in California. Eventually, John ends up in the Houston area in about 1950, and he becomes minister at Central Baptist Church in Baytown, which is located on Houston's east side. And Baytown in the mid-20th century was an emerging kind of petrochemical capital in the Gulf Coast South. And prior to taking the leadership helm at Central Baptist Church, John gets married and has a son. And so he and his new family, they move to Baytown and they start ministering. John, under John's administration, the church grows numerically. He's heavily involved in the San Jacinto Baptist Association. He develops an interest in missionary work, specifically to Mexico, and he's involved in early attempts at televangelism. But for reasons that he never made clear, and reasons that his son Joel has never made clear, John Osteen ends up getting divorced right about 1955. And he resigns from Central Baptist Church and spends a little bit of time continuing his itinerant ministry, but also developing business interests. And as he indicates in his writings, shortly after that, he meets a nurse named Dodie Pilgrim. And he meets Dodie in the context of visiting parishioners at the hospital. Soon thereafter, he and Dodie Pilgrim get married, and they eventually have five children. But early on, the firstborn the firstborn daughter of John and Dodie Osteen develops some muscular problems right after she was born. Lisa Osteen is who I'm talking about. And she eventually becomes more physically agile, and she seemingly recovers from this muscular problem. Her parents are deeply concerned, and in seeking to get their daughter well, they not only appeal to medicine and doctors, but John cries out to God, as he says. And he, in the midst of this, he begins to search the New Testament for the possibility that his daughter could become better through divine healing. And in the late 1950s, as a result of this quest, John Osteen becomes charismatic, and he becomes linked to the emerging neo-Pentecostal movement. And so as a result of birth defects of his daughter, John Osteen becomes charismatic. Now, the way that I interpret this episode in his life is, you know, he experiences something of a midlife crisis. Perhaps he interprets Lisa's health troubles as a divine judgment on the dissolution of his first marriage. But whatever the case, the fact that Lisa improved health-wise is evidence for him that healing exists, that divine healing is present in the 20th century, and so this kind of launches him in a new direction. As a Southern Baptist, his denomination does not necessarily welcome people of the charismatic or Pentecostal persuasion. And so he eventually starts really an independent non-denominational church as a result of these experiences. And this leads to directly into the founding of Lakewood Church. As a, even though it had a Baptist imprint, it begins really with non-denominational charismatic roots connected to the larger neo-Pentecostal movement that followed World War II.
Let me pause you a minute here, because if we have a number of different listeners all around the world, and if you're talking to, say, some New England Congregationalists, they might not necessarily know the difference between a Southern Baptist and a Charismatic Christian or a Neo-Pentecostal. You kind of look down south, and you all look the same. So what is the difference between the Southern Baptists and the Charismatics, and specifically in relation to what might have gotten them into some hot water with the Southern Baptist or pushed them out the door?
Sure. The history of Pentecostalism in America, you know, begins with Azusa Street, and from there you have what the typical classical Pentecostal denominations, the Assemblies of God, the Church of God in Christ, but also an emphasis on divine healing, an emphasis on speaking in tongues, these sort of expressions. The neo-Pentecostal charismatic movement after World War II featured similar sorts of religious expressions, the speaking in tongues, the notion of divine healing, but these episodes and these experiences were chronicled not just in the classical Pentecostal denominations, but all throughout Protestant and Catholic Christianity in the United States. So there were Northern Baptists, Southern Baptists, Nazarenes, Roman Catholics who were talking about and experiencing these charismatic expressions. And some in the Southern Baptist Convention, John's denomination, welcomed these expressions as an outpouring of divine activity. Other members saw it as disorderly. They saw it as something that wasn't what respectable Christians did. It was unfettered. It was out of control. And so the church that John was ministering at, when he began to experience these Pentecostal manifestations, was a place called Hibbard Memorial Baptist Church in Houston. And in essence, the congregation and the congregation's leadership, the deacons, were split on the question of whether or not these Pentecostal expressions of religion were authentic and quote-unquote true Christianity. And at that point, John resigned from Hibbard Memorial and started at Lakewood Church. So ultimately it was a question or a split within the Southern Baptist Convention, but it was really much broader and much larger within numerous denominations, in both in the American South but also across the country.
Okay, that helps out a little bit and does connect this to broader patterns in Christian history here in the United States. Let's return back to Lakewood Church. We left off in 1959. How does this church start changing throughout the 1960s, and more specifically in the 1970s? You have a chapter that really talks about a transitional period that starts to occur in the 1970s through the 80s.
Yeah, Lakewood Church in the 1960s developed and grew somewhat, but one of the discoveries I made in my research was that John Osteen began traveling as a global evangelist around 1961, and he left the church to a man named Marvin Crowe. So Marvin Crowe, in essence, was Lakewood's full-time minister on site, shall we say, throughout much of the 1960s. It's not that John was not involved in Lakewood Church. He was there and stayed in contact with Lakewood congregants. But he was traveling the world, and he met Marvin Crowe through his work with the Full Gospel Businessmen's Association, which was an outreach and evangelistic ministry started by a man named Demos Shakarian, who was friends with Oral Roberts, and so it was a kind of businessman's or business person's outreach ministry. And so John was an invited speaker. Not only was Oral Roberts part of that circle, but people like T.L. Osborne and Kenneth Hagin, and these ministers located in Oklahoma were very influential on John, and so he utilized these networks and left Lakewood, in essence, in the care of somebody who he met in this network. So Osteen traveled the world in the 1960s to South America. He ministered in Mexico and itinerated elsewhere. But by the late 1960s, it was, as John says, time to come home. His family was growing. By that point, he had four, going on five children, and so it was time for John to be present. And so in the late 60s, John returns to Houston as the full-time, as Lakewood's full-time minister. Marvin Crowe kind of disappears from the story, and the documentary record, I wish, told us more about this particular chapter of Lakewood's history. But several things resulted in Lakewood's growth in the 1970s.
Let me just stop you a minute and ask you about what happens to Marvin Crowe. Again, you say he kind of disappears from the story. We don't know. We don't have a lot of documentation what happens, but is this something like Crowe says, oh yeah, you know, the prodigal son comes back home, and so I'll, you know, kind of bow out? Or was this, hey, I'm back, get out of here? Was it more conflictual? Do we have any sense of that?
I didn't get a sense that it was any, that there was any friction between John Osteen and Marvin Crowe. One of my interviewees talked about the fact that they had known Marvin Crowe, I believe, in the 1970s as a missionary in Mexico. So it sounds like after he left Lakewood, then he continued his launched into missionary work after that. But I think it was also a time in which Osteen was needed at home by his family, and so it was a time where it was a good transition time. Perhaps he was weary from the hectic travel schedule, but also ready to be home full time.
Yeah, it seems like they just flipped roles, I guess.
Sure, absolutely.
Yeah. So what happens in the 70s?
Well, in the 70s, Lakewood experiences considerable growth, so that by the late 1970s, the church is thousands strong, which means in the modern sense of the definition, Lakewood was a megachurch by the end of the 1970s. But in my reading of the history, several factors contributed to that growth. I mean, on the one hand, there is demographic growth in Houston. In another sense, the modern civil rights movement, the modern black freedom struggle, took place in Houston while Osteen was traveling abroad. And so, unlike a number of Anglo ministers at the time, Osteen didn't necessarily have to take a public stance one way or the other in support of integration, etc. And so in some ways, when he returns to Houston in the 1970s, he's the beneficiary of an integrated Houston. At the same time, he chooses to keep Lakewood Church in its original location on the northeast side of Houston, a kind of multi-ethnic, working-class area. And so this, the fact that Osteen stayed, he didn't move the church to the suburbs. He didn't move the church, or to the outer suburbs, I should say. He didn't move the church into areas that were less racially diverse or economically diverse, and it seems to me that this meant something to people, and so they began to attend Lakewood in larger numbers at that point.
Okay. And what goes on then in the 1980s, and as you talk about the twilight of John in the 1990s, where's the church heading?
Well, the church continues to grow and expand along in the 1980s and thereafter, along with the increasingly large number of mega churches. The other fact in the 1980s is that one of John's sons, Joel Osteen, returns to Houston after a short time at Oral Roberts University, and he launches Lakewood's television ministry. So this is around 1982, 1983. And this helps to put Lakewood on the map even further. Within the neo-Pentecostal movement of the 1970s and 1980s, John was a well-known entity. He was a common speaker at conventions, etc. But the growth of the television ministry in the 1980s put Lakewood on a much broader, much larger national map. At the same time, John was also traveling, doing evangelistic outreach and preaching events across the world. And so the name of Lakewood Church, coupled with John Osteen, was on the move in that regard. And the twilight of John's career took place in the 1990s. As he was getting advanced in years, he had some cardiac heart issues that slowed him down, and some kidney issues as well. And so guest preachers would come in, but it was a time of transition into the late 1990s for Lakewood Church.
And I can see the role of Joel start to emerge here. As you mentioned, in the early 1980s, he is the guy who is promoting the television aspect of the ministry. Does he easily then move into the role as his father starts to fade from the scene?
Well, as Joel tells the story, you know, his father had asked him to preach numerous times, and Joel had rebuffed his father's request.
Yeah, typical pastor's kid, huh? typical pastor's kid, huh?
Right. Yeah, right.
Always the troublemaker, I guess. Yeah.
That's right. And so upon John's passing, as Joel tells the story, he sort of had some kind of divine confirmation that he should become Lakewood's minister, and in early 1999 then begins to minister at Lakewood Church and becomes the congregation's main minister. So in Joel's telling, it's a kind of providential, it's an unfolding providential tale where Osteen kind of seamlessly transitions. Now, I didn't have access, in terms of the documentary record, to the kind of transition of leadership within that. The family at the time and since has maintained a kind of broader leadership role within the congregation. In the 1990s, Lisa Osteen, John's daughter, was a regular teacher and minister at the church, as was John's son-in-law named Gary Simons, who was married to another daughter named April. And Gary was also a minister, and he did music and so forth. And so there were, I suppose, several possibilities of who might assume the mantle upon John's death, including his widow, Dodie. But as I surveyed and researched Lakewood Church in the 1980s, it seemed that Joel became John's kind of right hand. He not only directed the television ministry, he engaged in kind of marketing campaigns. All of the photographs that I found in local Houston newspapers of Lakewood stories and John and Osteen, Joel is always present in these photographs. So in a very real sense, in retrospect, it seems that Joel was the likely candidate to take John's spot in the church. And also another interview I conducted with a well-known scholar of American Christianity, Ed Harrell, who has written extensively on the neo-Pentecostal movement. He, in my interview with him, talked about a meeting with John in the 1990s where inevitably the question of succession came up. And according to Harold, John had mentioned Joel as a possibility. So as I dug into the historical record and began to try to interpret these larger events, it seemed that given Joel's experience at the kind of highest leadership levels of Lakewood Church, that he was a likely candidate to assume duties from his father. Not to mention the fact that he was well acquainted with the broader field of religious broadcasting.
Mm-hmm. And how does the church then expand after Joel takes over? And when, if you had to put a date on the official transition, was it 2000, 2001? When was it?
Yeah, I would say the official transition was early 1999. John passed away early that year, and then Joel begins to preach fairly quickly and regularly after that. And so that's the kind of leadership transition time. I'm sure things were happening behind the scenes that no historian has been privy to at this point, but at least publicly that seems to be the really important, one of the important transition points in the career of Joel Osteen.
And then how does the Lakewood Church grow in the 2000s?
Well, it grows for a number of reasons. Number one, Joel continues expanding the television ministry, and he does so in a number of ways. He had a deep experience in religious programming and religious broadcasting, and so he was, through the work that he did with the John Osteen telecast, his father's broadcast, he was able to maintain connections and consult with media folks to expand various markets. At the same time, I think, in one sense, Joel Osteen grew into being a televangelist as he began to survey the emerging new media, social media, and the new media landscape. By the early 2000s, given his broad experience within televangelism, he ended up, in hindsight, rightly anticipating the emergence of and the use of social media. And so as Facebook came on the scene, as YouTube came on the scene, as Twitter emerged in the early 2000s and mid-2000s, the middle decade of the first decade of the 2000s, he began to take advantage of these multiple media modalities and really was able to literally put his face not just on television but across digital media. And so this led to exponential growth in terms of viewers and listeners. But at the same time, Lakewood ended up moving locations. In essence, it outgrew its original location. And so Joel moved the church from the northeast side to an area known as Greenway Plaza, which is home to retail spaces, home to businesses, and it gave Lakewood Church a kind of visibility along one of the main highways that goes through Houston. And it added space for the church to grow. And so all of these developments happened within 5 or 6 years, and it helped to kind of catapult Joel Osteen into being a household name.
Now, one of the things that Joel Osteen is famous for being connected to is something called the prosperity gospel, and I want to cover that a little bit now. And even though he's associated with it, the ideas of the prosperity gospel go back to his father as well as a few other people. So describe the origins of this prosperity gospel and the dimensions of it.
Sure. The origins of the prosperity gospel, as historian Kate Bowler has brilliantly shown in her book on the broader history of the prosperity gospel movement, has its roots in 19th century New Thought and it develops as well in this neo-Pentecostal revival that I spoke about previously, and this is John's entry into the prosperity gospel movement. And so if we think about the prosperity gospel in a kind of generic explanatory sense, really it's a message of using the Bible to sanction material attainment of various kinds. And so a number of the early neo-Pentecostal ministers, people such as Oral Roberts, T.L. Osborne, Kenneth Hagin, people who influenced John Osteen, became early advocates of this message. And the importance of Bowler's work here on the broader history of the prosperity gospel, she talks about a kind of hard prosperity and soft prosperity doctrine, meaning an emphasis on the one hand of hard prosperity on the acquisition of financial resources, large homes, yachts, this sort of thing, ministers holding out the promise that this is divinely sanctioned according to scriptures in the Bible, and then a kind of soft prosperity that doesn't necessarily focus solely on money, but the idea of psychological wholeness, the idea of stable relationships, the idea of health. And so if we were to understand the broader landscape of the prosperity gospel, I think those are really helpful ways to make sense of it. John's major influences in the 60s and 70s, major prosperity gospel influences, were connected to these teachings about material wealth, material attainment. But because John's own life story connected to instances of what he defined as divine healing, not just of his daughter, but his wife Dodie's recovery from cancer in the 1980s, then John tended to emphasize the fact of what he referred to as the Bible's promise for prosperity, but also he ended up emphasizing health and what he called divine healing as well.
And talk a little bit more about that and how that factors into Joel Osteen's theology, because we oftentimes associate the prosperity gospel with just the material aspects of it, and that's kind of a pretty easy thing to understand. If you pray really hard, God will bless you and you'll have a nice house and, you know, maybe you'll shape up your life and your income will get better, etc., etc. But I found this interesting in your book too, is the focus on the body, right? And also emotional well-being, this providence of positive outcomes. Tell us a little bit about that, how that plays out, not only in Joel's philosophy, but John's theology as well.
That's right. And I think ultimately the prosperity gospel is a very complex movement. It's not just one, there's not just one aspect to the prosperity gospel. And again, I think that's one of the benefits of Bowler's work in this regard. And it's hard to sort of neatly summarize in that way. And I think the other thing operating here is that many of the advocates of the prosperity gospel, say particularly in the 1980s, experienced well-documented televangelist scandals.
Yeah.
And so all of this kind of created a deep and in many ways well-placed skepticism of televangelists, but also a kind of immediate association with televangelism connected to the prosperity gospel. And so as we kind of step back to try to understand those nuances, then we see, and this is what I found in the documentary record with John Osteen, he distanced himself from what we might call the crassest forms of the prosperity gospel, where you pray for a yacht, you pray for a Rolls Royce or Mercedes-Benz. And instead of that message, John emphasized what he called biblical confessions of prosperity. And so the booklets that he published, the sermons that he preached, would list various passages of the Bible. And so the idea was to claim, quote-unquote, claim these passages for some kind of prosperity. Again, it's not always financial. It's health-related. It is this idea of spiritual advancement, but also the recovery of Dodie Osteen from cancer in the 1980s. She began to emphasize this notion of prosperity in terms of good health and healthy living during that particular period. And so this kind of left its imprint in many ways on Joel Osteen. And so as he began to really settle on the core themes of his message, which took a couple of years to kind of hammer out, again, he began ministering in 1999, and the main themes of his prosperity gospel message did not come into clear view in my reading of the history, really until 2001, 2002, 2003 in this particular period. And so, like his father, John, Joel emphasized positive thinking. Like John Osteen, Joel emphasized positive confession. But Joel also had additional influences in the creation of his prosperity gospel outside of his father. And those two main influences were Joyce Meyer, a neo-Pentecostal prosperity teacher, and John Maxwell, who has done both leadership consulting as well as this idea of focusing on opportunities and personal achievement. And early on, particularly in 1999, Joel preached many of his earliest sermons based on influences from, for example, Joyce Meyer and the importance of positive thinking, describing the mind as a battlefield. And this is taken from the title of one of Joyce Meyer's books in the 1990s. And so we see a kind of direct influence here where Joel is building on this particular aspect of one of his influences. And then with John Maxwell, Joel Osteen adopts a kind of discourse of achieving dreams and discovering the newness of personal possibility or personal improvement. And so Joel connects this, I argue in the book, to his notion of what I call a providence of positive outcomes. And this is an aspect, a dimension of his prosperity teaching that emphasizes the idea that God is always intending good for somebody and that inevitably things will work out for the better. Even though things may not look good today, there is that promise or that providence, which, interestingly enough, is a kind of Calvinist idea that Joel settles on. But this idea that God intends nothing but the best and that things will ultimately improve. And so this is what I define as a providence of positive outcomes, a kind of nuance that Joel Osteen makes within his own prosperity gospel message. And then the other piece of the fourth dimension, I should say, to Joel Osteen's prosperity gospel is what I call the prosperity gospel of the body. And this is a really fascinating piece to the story because Joel Osteen, in his teachings and in his books and in his sermons, he recognizes the notion of divine healing through the story of his mother defeating cancer, through the story of his sister recovering from early muscular difficulties at birth. But he sort of experiences divine healing by proxy because he lets Dodie and Lisa tell their own stories. Joel Osteen, to date, or to at least what I found in the documentary record, does not have a dramatic story of healing personally. In fact, he was an avid player of various sports growing up. He was always, it seems to me, conscious of healthy eating and healthy exercise habits. And so in many ways, Joel Osteen was living your best life now, to adopt the title of his first book. in the sense of physical health, as a runner, as a weightlifter. And in his sermons, he began to emphasize the importance of healthy eating, healthy living, exercise, monitoring caloric intake. And this was a new dimension to the prosperity gospel for Joel Osteen that allowed him to distinguish himself from other prosperity gospel ministers, but also to answer critics to say, hey, look, my message isn't just about financial and material attainment. It's about psychological wholeness. It's about relational well-being. It's about health and fitness. And so in this way, he was able to distinguish his own message in the broader landscape, but also build on what he had learned from his father.
It's a very interesting picture that you're painting here of Joel Osteen, because, again, a lot of his critics see him as, you know, basically giving out Christianity light or just selling some psychobabble snake oil, and occasionally mentions Jesus in the mix of all that kind of stuff. You had the opportunity to be going to Lakewood Church over the course of a decade or so and talking to a lot of people that were going there. What were your impressions of how people in the congregation actually absorbed this message? Was there some dissension? Did people start saying, oh, Osteen, this is Christianity light. I need to go back to my roots, some fire and brimstone stuff. What was your impression of how the people there took to the message?
Yeah, in many ways, the people who I talked to, certainly they were supporters of the message of positive Christianity, shall we say. But the people that I talked to, everybody had their own distinct, unique story of finding a second chance in life. And so really this is the theme that I found in the people that I talked with. It doesn't necessarily mean that the people I interviewed expressed total happiness with everything that was going on in the church, but it meant that they, through their own experiences, found and settled on this idea of a second chance. Some of the stories that I unpack in the book from the people interviewed, some had various difficulties early in life based on decisions that they made that resulted in drug use and alcoholism. And what they found at Lakewood was people who welcomed them despite their shortcomings and ultimately supported them in their quest for self-improvement and spiritual enlightenment. Other people had health problems and specifically sought out Lakewood leaders to pray for them based on the leader's own experiences with health issues. Other people had hit rock bottom in life and literally wanted to be in a space where they felt encouraged. And it doesn't mean that people who experienced or attained a second chance in life, what I call, based on the work of Dan McAdams, the redemptive self. Even though people found their redemptive selves at Lakewood Church, didn't necessarily mean that they would continue attending the church. And one person I interviewed described that Lakewood was good for a season, but then they wanted to swim in deeper spiritual or theological waters. Attending at Lakewood and talking with people, I came to understand that people interpreted Joel's teachings and the church's broader teachings through their own life experiences, but this notion of a spiritual makeover, this notion of a second chance, this notion of finding a redemptive self was something that that tied everything together. And I should also add, these were people who chose to attend these adult education classes and attempted to engage the congregation outside of the worship experience. And so some of these individuals referenced the fact that, you know, not everybody who attended Lakewood ended up staying. And so, but it was hard to pin down what those numbers were, what those numbers are, due to the lack of documentary evidence or statistical analysis in that sense that was made available.
I want to finish up with a couple questions here. First of all, what has Lakewood Church given to American Christianity? What kind of imprint has it had? And again, at least the Joel Osteen version of it is still relatively new, and so we'll still have to be watching how it shapes Christianity. But, you know, even dating back to John Osteen, how has Lakewood impacted American Christianity?
Yeah, in one sense, I think you're right. I mean, I think we'll have to see what the future holds in a more longitudinal sense to make an ultimate assessment. But to answer your question, I mean, I think on the one hand, at least for people who advocate a kind of congregational growth, Lakewood is seemingly an exemplar for its size, for its use of programs, for its use of highly trained and well-trained professional musicians in terms of local worship, its pioneering use of religious media outside of television, so engaging with social media and then now with Sirius XM radio, but also for many observers of congregational growth and congregational history, Lakewood Church exists as a multiracial congregation. Now, having talked about Lakewood as a multiracial congregation, we should also point out that it is very much statistically diverse in terms of the composition of the congregation. The leadership at this point still remains largely Anglo, although in recent years an African-American minister named John Gray was hired and preaches at the church. So in some ways, this helps to explain from one vantage point the larger influence. With regard to religion and media, there's a sense in which Joel Osteen has re-enchanted American televangelism to some extent, to use a scholarly term. And what I mean by this is there's a reason why millions of people tune in to Joel Osteen every week. There's a reason he is across many streams of digital television. And part of this broader impact is that Joel Osteen offers a predictable message in unstable times of economic calamity, global terrorism. And in this way, we can connect his broader influence to that of Norman Vincent Peale, who in the mid-20th century, in the early Cold War, also offered a predictable message of self-improvement during the unstable times of the early Cold War and the threat of nuclear conflict. I think we might also assess Lakewood's larger impact by examining closely Osteen's critics, particularly his New Calvinist critics. And I detail this story in the final chapter of the book. But in one sense, the fact that Joel Osteen has so many critics is one way to see and understand his broader impact and his broader influence. His critics criticize him for what they call a Christless Christianity, quote-unquote, to use the title of one of his critics' books, and worse, something that is not Christian at all. And so in this way, this attention suggests Osteen's popularity and impact as well. After all, if Osteen wasn't an evangelical in that sense, in my reading of it, his critics wouldn't spend so much time decrying his ministry.
Let me finish up with this question. You've had a chance to reflect on this project for 10-plus years and think about it in a very unique way, as a way of a scholar, as an outsider who had been into small denominations, now walking into a large mega church. Is there anything throughout the process of studying Lakewood and the Osteens that really surprised you and changed your mind about anything?
Yeah, in many ways, the influence and the importance of John Osteen was one of the surprising research discoveries. And what I mean by that is, in my research on the Neo-Pentecostal movement following the end of World War II, John, I found his publications, his photographs, all over the place in Neo-Pentecostal literature. So in the literature of the Full Gospel Businessmen's Association, in publications by Oral Roberts and T.L. Osborne, and in the earliest chapters of televangelism in the 70s and 80s. And so I didn't see that early on. I knew that John had founded the church, but I didn't realize the extent of his influence. And so that was a really interesting and surprising research discovery. I also learned quite a bit about the connection between the prosperity gospel and the use of modern technology and the importance of televangelism within that broader framework. And I also learned quite a bit about the history of criticism, religious criticism of popular evangelists and teachers, comparing, for example, the critics of Norman Vincent Peale with those of Joel Osteen, but also trying to understand history as it happened, if I can put it that way. Because when I started this project in 2005, Joel Osteen had just moved into the former Compaq Center, I should say. He had published one book. And so in many ways, as a historian, I was trying to sort of chronicle history as it happened. And so that was a really delightful challenge from the sense of thinking about the discipline of history and trying to track these particular developments.
Well, we are certainly glad that you found this to be a delightful challenge and that you wrote it up in a book called Salvation with a Smile, Joe Osteen, Lakewood Church, and American Christianity. My guest today has been Philip Sinanter. Philip, thanks for being on Research on Religion.
Thanks, Tony. I enjoyed being with you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.